Hi everyone, Data Stories number 17, again on the Google Hangout. We cannot stop doing that, Moritz. How are you?
Great, thanks Enrico, how are you? Have you recovered a bit from your flu?
It's been crazy. I had a long, last week I was so sick. I mean, it was crazy. I don't know what kind of flu they have here on the other part, on the other side of the ocean. I never had such a strong flu. It's crazy. I'm still recovering. Anyway, now I'm fine. I'm in my office and I feel much, much better. How about you?
Good, good. I mean, I'm just having a cold, but probably not comparable to your killer flu. It's been yeah, crazy. And the year is starting to kick in, so now everybody wants to do projects and has funny ideas and so on.
Yeah, we are all overwhelmed. Anyway, so let's start with the main topic of this episode. We have a couple of guests today, and we're going to talk about data sculptures, or also known as physical visualization. So we have Yvonne Janssen and Pierre Dragicevic from Paris. Hi, Pierre. Hi, Yvonne. How are you?
Hi, good.
Hi.
So it's great to have you on the show today. So let me give a brief introduction about you, who you are, and why we decided to have this episode. So Pierre and Yvonne, they are researchers in at the IRIA in Paris, one of the leading data visualization and human-computer interaction groups. And the reason why we organized this episode on data sculpture is because I met them some months ago at the This Week conference, and I saw the fantastic work they have been doing on analyzing physical visualizations, which basically means instead of having visualization displayed on the screen, there is a physical object that shows the data, and they are going to show us some of these little toys. And after the meeting them at This Week, we stayed in touch, and I discovered they have a nice web page where they are collecting examples of physical visualizations. And another interesting thing we are going to talk about today is a study that they recently ran, an experiment comparing different kinds of visualizations, some digital, some physical, anything. They're going to explain us what the results of these studies are. So Pierre and Yvonne, do you want to introduce yourself a little better and tell to our listeners who you are, what you are doing, what are your interests first? Pierre, you want to start?
Yeah, I guess you already introduced me. So I'm basically a researcher at INRIA at the AVIS team, working on information visualization and human-computer interaction. My background is actually human-computer interaction originally, and I started doing research on InfoVis when I joined INRIA in 2007. So it's been already 5 years, but I still consider myself as a novice and newcomer. Yes.
And Yvonne?
Yes, I'm a PhD student, supervised by Pierre and Jean-Daniel Fiquet, and I'm working on physical information visualization. And I'm, exploring how physical objects can be used for information visualization.
Okay, great. So can I suggest, before we move on to describing anything, can you show us any of these tools that you've been building so people can understand what we are talking about before we move on to describe
my office is filled with these little objects, which is basically what I studied last year.
Yeah,
and which I evaluated to find out whether those are actually suitable to read the data, not just as pretty colorful objects.
Yeah. So can you guys briefly, I would like to start from describing the study that you run, because I think it's a very interesting study with interesting results. Can you briefly describe what you did and what you found?
Okay, so as I said, we wanted to assess whether these objects are actually useful to read the data. So we built a lot of those, 13 to be exact. And we created this equivalent screen versions. And we wanted to see how they differ in efficiency to be to solve simple tasks, to read values, to deal with occlusion and to find data points and compare them in size. Mm-hmm. And so we compared this to the same thing on screen, which I currently cannot show. Anyways, it looks almost the same. Could similarly be manipulated with the mouse just by rotating it, basically these angles. And yes, so we also included two control conditions for this to see how much this is due to stereo cues. So with a physical object, you always have perfect stereo cues. So we had the stereoscopic condition with a 3D screen and a 2D control condition where we had a very nice interactive 2D visualization where you could basically get something like a top view as a matrix. And you could click rows or columns to get a slice, a 2D slice. And so what we basically found is that, yes, 2D works better. You get a very nice 2D cut. And as long as the task can be solved with this cut, it works very well. But the physical works better than an on-screen version. And for this, this basically made us wonder why, how come, what are the benefits, since the stereoscopic didn't really help.
Okay, so basically what you found is that 2D is always better, but as soon as you move to a 3D representation, then physical is better, right? So if you have a 3D representation of this bar chart on the screen, that's going to perform worse than the physical counterpart, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Can I ask one question about the data and about the tasks people had to do?
Yes, so the data, those are all country indicators taken from Gapminder, actually, from the data sets available on the Gapminder website. And so this, for example, is armed forces personnel. So how many people in the country work in the army? Oh, I have another one on how much money is spent on education. I have one on unemployment rates.
So what are the axes? Is it countries and years or countries?
Exactly. It's countries against years.
Countries against years. Okay.
So one color is one country. Then the other axis are the years.
Yeah. And the task would be to compare two values or to find the highest or lowest, or what did people have to do?
We have three tasks. So one was to find one country, to identify one country, and then give the range. So basically the lowest and the highest value for that country, which actually required to read the values. Another task was to sort all countries for 1 year ascendingly, so which required a lot of turning around to deal with occlusion. And the third one was to find three specific data points and say which one is the lowest.
Okay. Yeah.
And this was the only task which could not be solved with a 2D cut, since they were all non-adjacent. And so for this one, the 2D performed still better, but the difference was much lower. So there it was only 15. And in overall, I think it was something like 40% difference, something around that.
Okay. And then you had some follow-up studies to understand why physical visualization performed better in some cases.
Yes, exactly. So we videotaped the participants and looked at how they solved the tasks. And so we found that they used their fingers a lot for to mark and to retrieve values, to orient themselves within the chart. And so the more they did this, the better they seemed to perform. And so we wanted to test this hypothesis. And so we did a second experiment where we basically had only the physical and the on-screen. And we added two conditions where we tried to make the on-screen version better by giving a physical control. So they rotated in the same way. They had, so that's this one actually. Uh-huh. It's a prop. So there's a sensor underneath, and it was directly linked to the on-screen model. So you could manipulate it in the same way. Uh-huh. But you saw the data on the screen. And for the physical, we had two different versions. One, we explicitly asked people to use their fingers to help solve the task. And the other one, we reminded them constantly to not do that.
Okay.
And so what we found in the end was that, yes, using your fingers gives you an advantage, makes you faster. It was about 15, 18%, something like that. But even without the fingers, this was still faster than the prop. It was about roughly the same distance between the touch and the no touch and the no touch and the prop. But
so this means that there is a value in actually seeing the physical artifact.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And touching it.
And yes. Touching it, of course.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, also participants found it kind of frustrating to not being able to touch.
And, I can imagine. because you're also always tempted to touch it, right?
Oh, yes. It's a physical object. It's kind of invites you to touch it.
Yeah, I actually remember the first time I saw it when we were at this week, the first thing I did was taking it, holding it in my hands and really touch it. You feel like you try to solve some kind of questions and the first thing you do is touch it. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yes, it's a very nice property of physical objects. But Pierre has an example for physical objects where you actually cannot touch the data. So this is not necessarily included.
Yes.
Do you have it there?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have it.
You have more toys to show, Pierre?
This is using, this is another thing that we tried. Actually, I wanted to try that. It's a subsurface engraving. The piece of glass. I think you saw this in some stores. It's usually more kitsch stuff like dolphins and souvenirs. But you can actually ask, can actually send a 3D model to some stores and they will make it for you. And
why, is it laser etched or how do they do it?
It's laser subsurface engraving. So there is a laser here moving and which can focus at any height and it's extremely precise and fast.
Yeah.
And so it creates micro, oh yes, it creates micro bubbles. So I wanted to see if you could, which resolution you could, for example, draw characters, labels, and lines, you know, those were for grid lines.
Uh-huh.
It's actually very precise. And why was that interesting? It's because, but Ivan will talk about that with about the process of digital fabrication. You cannot build everything using a 3D printer or a laser cutter because you cannot build objects which float in the air, for example. And using a laser cutting, like Ivan did, works for 3D bar charts, for example, because they can physically exist. But 3D scatter blots, for example, you have those things floating in the air. It's more difficult to build. So with that, you can do almost any 3D object. But so we did that. It's just a test. This was a test. We paid about 60 euros for that. There are several problems with that though. And I'm a bit less excited about that now. Although some people proposed to use that for scientific visualization. There is an article from Paul Bourque, I believe. Yes, a poster who's from University of Western Australia who did a poster about using that to communicate scientific data. So, okay, one problem is that you can see that there is refraction, right? Some objects are doubled. Yeah. So it kind of changes the perception of depth. It's a bit weird. It's like in an aquarium or when you see those fishes. There's reflection, which doesn't help reading. Objects don't cast shadows, which is a bit weird. So they don't seem really, they don't seem real. And you cannot touch them. You cannot touch the data. And that's something that we found, that even found after the experiment. Actually, we didn't know about that really. We're really more interested into how people perceive those objects, but turns out it's very important to be able to touch the data for some tasks. And
so you didn't expect that. Are you saying that you didn't expect at the beginning that touch would be so important? It's more something discovered during the study?
No, I was really interested in perception. And I think Yvonne was more interested in, the way you can actually handle a physical object and interact with it somehow. But I thought, yeah, when you talk about physical, tangible objects, everyone says touch, you can touch them, but what's the point? Okay, you have eyes, right? Eyes are much more powerful. But there is touch and touch. So, yeah, we have touch can mean many different things. It can be the tactile sense, right? It's sensing with your fingers. I think that's not that important as far as physical visualizations are concerned. But in Yvonne's experiment, people were much more, it helped them a lot because they had to mark, to highlight those, bars of interest and columns and rows. So it acts like a memory aid. And this is this is not really about the tactile sense. It's more about using your fingers to visually, as visual bookmarks.
Mm.
But there is proprioception too, which probably contributes. So, yeah.
So can I ask you guys, how did you come up with this idea at all? I'm wondering if there's a long story behind it or just you came up with this idea and said, well, let's do it.
It's difficult to. I think it's a follow-up work from Yvonne's first project about tangible user interfaces for information visualization.
Yes, this comes more from the idea of tangible interfaces from HCI, where Georges Fitzmaurice, he started with bricks to have physical representations of digital objects. And so when I started my thesis, my first project was about having physical controls for visualization, for wall-size display visualizations. And after that, this was kind of like the approaching this from the other end. And what about if we make the visualization itself physical and not just the control? And this was also kind of interesting since most InfoVis research is, it's screen-centered. Everything is about, screen visualizations. And so, we try to approach this from the other end and see how much can we do actually already with static physical visualizations. Mm-hmm. And so this is just kind of the beginning. And from there, there's a whole spectrum of more hybrid and active visualizations between the standard on-screen and the completely static that I studied so far.
Okay. And as Yvonne said, yes, what's interesting is that InfoVis has been mostly screen-centered, but also tangible. Research on tangible user interfaces, which dates back from, I don't know, even maybe 94, I guess, at least, has been almost exclusively input-centered. Like people were using, so this idea of reusing physical objects, right, something that we kind of lost since we introduced computers, reusing physical objects to improve user interfaces has been used almost for input. But yes, we are very good at manipulating physical objects, so there can be a benefit there. And including InfoVis, if you look at the work in InfoVis on tangible user interfaces, there is not much. There is Brig Ulmer's work, for example. It's and Petra Eisenberg, too, from our team. It's all about using physical objects for input, but then the visualization is still on the screen, right? And I think we are the first to do at least a controlled study about using physical objects as output to really display information.
Mm-hmm. So there is one thing that came into my mind. I was wondering, so the whole area of scientific visualization, when normally people, where the main task is really trying to kind of have a 3D representation of a physical object. So this could be something like, I don't know, the brain of a human, the heart, or I don't know, one of these... Yeah, or a wind tunnel where they study how wind goes through, I don't know, an airplane or whatever, right? So this looks to me like the perfect case where people might want to have some physical presentation of this data, because probably having the 3D representation, the physical representation of something that is originally a 3D object, hypothetically should work better. So I'm surprised that nobody did it so far. So do you know anything about it? Are there any, do you know if any researchers did similar studies to yours in the past that are more focused on the physical representation of 3D phenomena?
There has definitely been work on more model-oriented. So basically like models for molecules in chemistry, or there has been work to build physical models out of protein foldings and viruses that can, I don't know, there was a reassembling, auto-reassembling thing. So There's a lot of work out there about CIVIS data. Mm-hmm. And the kind of abstract InfoVis visualization, so far there's not that much, except for a few data sculptures.
I mean, what I found interesting when I sort of dived into the topic, and also when I discovered your great collection of projects, is that actually the most of the projects seem to come more from a design or art background.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So I think that's really interesting. That, I mean, that happens a couple of times, but here it's a great example of how maybe artists are fascinated by a certain form of expression, and just later it's being analyzed, you know, right, like how well it works or in which settings it works good or not. And I don't know, shall we briefly go
from the functional point of view?
Yeah. We could go through a few of the, let's say, the classic projects, if you like.
Yeah, that's another thing that we didn't mention yet. So Yvonne and Pierre have a very nice long list of data sculptures. I think we are going to put these links on the website after recording the show. So if I remember well, you have two lists, right? So one is passive physical visualizations and the other is active physical visualizations. So can you briefly tell us the story of this couple of lists that you keep maintaining there? Because it looks really impressive. I mean, the first time you sent the link to me, I was kind of shocked. I couldn't believe there were so many examples around. So it looks like a brief history of physical visualization in a couple of web pages.
Yes. Okay. So this started as kind of a collection of examples of what has been done so far and how have physical visualizations been used in the past. We were surprised ourselves that there are so many examples and that they are very old examples too. We have some from 30, well, it's appeared in a book from 39, so they are probably even much older. And there are some very nice examples from, I don't know, like the maps with Jeff reliefs for, I actually don't know what the relief is there. I don't know. Do you know, Pierre? I think, yes, you added this one.
Yes.
The physical maps.
Yeah, there are many. So I think we kind of we make the difference, at least in our paper, between functional physical visualizations, as you mentioned, and those which are come from more design and art, and whose goals are a bit different. And it's true that these days, today, maybe 99.9% of physical visualizations come from design and art. So there is a huge variety of things, very exciting things, and people like it. I mean, they keep emailing each other about, oh, look at this new data sculpture. So yeah, this is a big trend, and we've been partly inspired by that. But, and I will maybe talk about it a bit later by showing some examples. There are examples of functional physical visualizations which date back from 35 and even the beginning of the 20th century. And they have been built for really doing visual analytic tasks. And the reason why they disappeared is very simple, is that it's with computers, because those are difficult to build. And they were worth building before. Today, maybe less, but I think part of our work is showing that they are still worth investigating. Yes, made this distinction in our webpage between passive and active visualizations. Maybe even you want to explain what's the difference.
Well, the difference there is basically that the statics, the passive, are completely passive. They don't contain any electronics. And the active ones, they are in some way, all of them are electronic, either by some motors or LED lights or I don't know, what else is there?
These are physical visualizations that can change their appearance, right?
Yes, well, actually, it's a bit more complicated since you. I have an example actually for this one. Uh-huh. This one can be taken apart and resorted, for example. So you can reassemble it.
Okay, cool.
So where do you put this?
Yeah.
It's not really static anymore. So this becomes interactive, and so. Yes,
but it's not self-changing. Let's say it's just
this is manual labor.
Yeah, but that's really much along the lines of tools for thinking, and you also have that example of Bertin's matrices where he would rearrange like this Cartesian grid, and I think this idea of like thinking with your hands, I think it's very much. Info was taken to the extreme, if you think about it, like really grabbing the data and like putting it somewhere else. I think that's the ultimate you can get.
I think that the reorderable matrix from Bertin is probably one of the most, probably the most well-known physical visualization ever. Yeah. And if I remember the story correctly, I think Daniel Fiquet actually told the story to me. I think he met him and he showed to him the real reorderable matrix he did. And I think the story is basically what you said, Pierre, that at that time the technology was still not advanced enough. So the only way to create a proof of concept of the ideas he had in his mind was to actually build a physical object and reorder rows and columns and see whether there were any clever strategies to make interesting visual patterns out of some data, right?
Is yes, it correct? Yes, and I have a demo if you want.
You have a demo? Sure. Demo. We want to see the demo.
Okay. I have to move the camera a bit.
I like this. This episode is full of
magic
gadgets.
Tricks. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Rabbit.
So you have a reorderable matrix there.
Nice. Wow.
Somehow. Is it the original one or you made one yourself?
Actually, this is a simplified version. I just have to find the right way to put the camera. I think it worked yesterday. Very better nice. Than that. Yes, I guess like this would work. Yes. Yeah, no, this is actually, this has been built by a researcher called Inner Leaf from Tallinn University of Technology in Estonia. And he studied matrix reordering. He wrote a very, very interesting historical paper about matrix reordering. and he built those physical visualizations, those physical matrices, and he built different ones and he gave them to friends, including Jean-Daniel Fekete. So Jean-Daniel has this on his desk and he's showing it all the time and see, look, it's very nice, you can do this. But no one understands, really. So I emailed Inner and he explained to me how to use this, and I have a demo and I can make you a demo. So this is, okay, for those people who don't know, this is a matrix visualization. So why is the matrix visualization, why is it cool? Because it can show lots of things. So those are, a matrix visualization is basically a table, data table, but you replace numbers by shades of gray or maybe glyphs, whatever you want. You just replace numbers by small visualizations. This is a binary. It's just binary 0 or 1. Okay, here it's not very visible, but it's supposed to be dark and light wood. So it can show lots of things. This is a adjacency matrix, right? So if you have a link between this and this, then you have a dot. So you can show matrices with that, weighted matrices if you want to. And you can show multidimensional data. You know, this is the example from Bertin. The camera is a bit too close, but yes, this is basically, how can I show that better? Yes, those letters on the top are places. They are places, and every place has a feature. It has a school or not, it has or not a railway station, and yeah, you use those black squares. So, Inner Leaves shows that those kind of visualizations, which have been described by Bertin, but actually which have been used by scientists from the end of 19th century, are very, very common. They were used a lot. And the first thing that people did to analyze data is the reorder. This is very important because this is the reordered version of what I showed you. If you don't reorder, you don't see anything. If you reorder, you see a lot. You see groups, patterns, clusters. And reordering is very, very important. And it has been used in archaeology, for example, for relative dating. It has been used for classification, very important, and lots of people have been reordering matrix visualizations. But there were no algorithms at the beginning of the 20th century, and the reordering was done visually. It works well visually, but the problem is, how do you get from this, right? When you have no computer, remember, you have from this. This is, I have no idea how they did. But Bertin found a solution to that. So this is the matrix. So this is a subset actually of this is a subset of Bertin's his subset of the example I showed you before, which is famous example from his book. And I will show to you how it works. So use this to reorder. It's a bit like a Rubik's cube. You cannot move a cell without moving either the entire column or row. Okay, so there are holes. I can, for example, choose to move this cell. So I insert this here. I don't have much training, and it's very okay. So I will put that here because it's different. Then let me move this. Okay, that's fine here. Move this here. Then, you know, this line is similar to this one. So we move it closer, make some space. I think it's the first demo of Bertin's physical matrix ever. You can see lots of photos online, but only photos, right? There is no video, I think.
That's true. Yeah.
And I think no one understands how it works.
By the way, in the end, I think he made poster prints from that, right? So I once saw a photo where he had a big like light table or like light coming from above and photo.
Yes, he had huge matrices like that, which he actually used for actual projects, you know, and he had very more complicated device than that for reordering them. But he said with assistance and the proper devices, it only needs 3 days to build one. And 3 weeks to reorder them and understand the data. So that's fine.
2 weeks to find again the pieces your kids have carried in the other room.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't make sense today when you say that, right? I mean, 3 days to build the visualization and 3 weeks to analyze it. But in some situations, I think before people could spend lots of time and money building visualizations because some data sets are extremely important.
I mean, we discussed it a couple of times on the show already. So we had Stephanie Pozavec there as well, who does a lot by hand, let's say, on the computer using Illustrator, but still with manual actions.
And yes.
And in a way, the slow treatment of data, like really, you know, doing it step by step, it does have a different quality than just like flipping through like views superficially, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
And we had the same experience with the data cuisine where we cook, you know, data dishes. It's very simple data points, but these data points, you're thinking about them for a day or two, you know, and
yes,
really think hard about how to represent them and what they are and what they mean and where they come from. And I mean, Stephen Few, he wrote this article, I don't know if you read it, beginning of the year, about slow food and that there might be a slow data movement as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Mm. I think back then when there were no computers, people spent lots of time building those building visualizations. And here you can see, more or less, you can see clusters. Oh, wait a second. No, I prepared this. What do you think? Yes. Those are villages. Those are towns. You can see those three groups, right? Towns. They have veterinary, police station, and those are cities. They have a railway station, high school, police station. It's a real data. It's a subset of Bertin's data set. And I just reordered it for you.
That's fantastic. It's amazing. Thanks a lot. We have the first real demo of the reorderable matrix.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. I never saw it before. It makes a huge difference seeing it live. It's great. Now I want one in
So this is actually those simplified matrices, so built by Innerleave. They are okay. So Bertin's matrix is a bit different. Maybe I can use screen sharing to show you a few. There are a few pictures online, but maybe I can show you a few pictures here directly. You can see that I was using only one rod. Here there are a lot, and he actually has a technique. These are images from the PhD thesis from Nathalie Henry, and you can unlock rows and columns to reorder. So I suppose the way it works is that you can either manipulate all the rows are as single objects or all columns, and you can reorder like that. This is this is a bigger matrix. I'm not sure you can see, but this is huge. This is huge.
Yeah. And here I saw where I realized he is printing this.
Exactly. So here he was. I think according from Jean Daniel, who's really a specialist of Bertin, I'm not. He was using this kind of device to take pictures of those matrices once he built and reordered them. Yes. Manipulating, being able to manipulate those visualizations is very interesting. Something that we didn't investigate at all. And Yvonne showed, you know, this kind of 3D bar chart that you can reorder, countries. And so you can not only, you can change the configuration of physical visualizations very naturally, and you can also build them from scratch, as you mentioned. And that's a very interesting aspect of physical visualizations I think that we want to investigate too.
I think there's really a few intriguing things about them. And so one thing you often don't think about that much, but it's much easier to talk about data if you have an object everybody can look at. You know, a screen is always very, it's just for one person mainly, yeah? But an object you can view from all sides, you can point there and somebody else sees you pointing directly. And so it has this social aspect, and you can place them anywhere. So you can put them on your desk where you have a free space. And so I was wondering, you know, so now we have all these fabrication techniques. So you can mill fairly easily, you can laser etch, you can 3D print. I mean, have you thought about what happens in 10 years when 3D printers are, you know, like maybe as widespread as 2D printers now? Do you think there will be lots of data sculpture objects around, maybe also disposable ones that you just print out for a day or two and then throw them away again and they get composted and go somewhere else? Or do you think it's going to be still a niche and will remain that artsy type thing?
I think it will definitely become more popular to do this once the technology is readily available to everybody. Right now, you have to order it online or go to a fab lab somewhere in your city if you're lucky and your city has one. And I guess that 3D printers or whatever comes next that can do the same thing will become common. And there are already many people out there who do this kind of self-logging and who collect lots of data about themselves. And I think that those kind of people would probably be very interested to have an object representing all this data that they collected. And there are people working on more disposable and recyclable materials for 3D printing. So it's even kind of makes sense to just print an object and then later just throw it in the composter. And so there's a recycling process. It's even easier than with paper. You can do it yourself.
Maybe for people who are not familiar with digital fabrication, maybe you can say a few words about today's digital fabrication technologies and maybe how you built your physical visualizations.
Yeah, this is exactly what I was going to ask. So what's the current technology that you're using? Because maybe people want to do the same now, and I don't know if you want to share the secret with the others.
Sure. So there's a trend currently that more and more of those fab labs, fabrication laboratories, are popping up in mostly bigger cities for now. In Germany, there are lots already. In France, it's coming over the last couple of years, get more. In the US, I think there are a lot. And so they give the possibility to use 3D printers, laser cutters, 3D mills to create all kinds of 3D objects and make it accessible to normal people, to everybody. You can just go there and you take a tutorial for half an hour or an hour, and then you can start making things. And we are currently building such a fab lab here for a research collaboration. And at the current stage, we have a 3D printer and a laser cutter. And my favorite machine is the laser cutter, since it's very fast. And you can make all kinds of things, which are at first 2D. So those. This is a 3D object, but I made it out of 2D sheets of acrylic. So in the beginning, it looked like this, which is okay. Kind of...
So the original material you're using is acrylic?
Yes. It's made out of acrylic sheets, and it's transparent in the beginning, and I have lots of graffiti spray paint in my office now. And I give them color after. So this is kind of a workaround, since I don't have access to a color 3D printer, which is something that's coming up now, that you can actually print in full color. And there's, I think, who was that? Xerox? No. Some printer company in the US is coming up with a paper-based 3D printing technology where you kind of stack paper layers and you can print the paper in color, and so you get...
I think Staples is buying the technology.
Staples, that was it, yes.
So Yvonne, there is something that is not clear to me. If you have access to a 3D printer, do you still need a laser cutter?
Well, the 3D printer that we have is monocolor. So it only can do objects in one color. And this one is much more difficult to read than a multicolor version. And it's one object. Those are all connected. And so it would be much harder for me to color this.
So you prefer to use a laser cutter and color every single piece?
Yes, well, my personal preference would be to have a multicolor 3D printer.
Yeah, sure.
That's so fast.
They're currently really expensive still.
How long did it take to print this red thing?
This one actually took 24 hours.
That's
so
quite
they are still quite slow, but it's an older model. And I think now with the fastest ones available, now this would be doable in, I don't know, maybe an hour. I don't really know since I haven't used those. But there are some based on light. So they get really made one slice at a time. This one, basically, it's like a hot glue gun. So it's a thread of plastic that gets heated and a little printer head that drives around and makes every little slice of this. And it takes forever. And so now they have a technology where they use a photoreactive resin. I don't know the correct name for this, which basically reacts to light. So you have a fluid and a light gets projected onto it with the slice that you want with a 3D layer. And the entire thing is gets solid at the same time. So you, basically it grows out of the liquid. And that's much faster and higher resolution.
But just to add, I mean, there's a lot of lo-fi techniques you can use as well. So on your page, you have examples made from cardboard. So you can layer cardboard, you know, and you cut it in different ways. So you can create these mountains of things. You can use Lego. You can use Play-Doh. There was this beautiful exhibition of all the people in the world where each person in the world was symbolized with a grain of rice. And then they had different heaps of, you know, grains of rice. And you just basically need rice and a scale, you know, and with the scale, you can do the measurement and then make a big heap of something. So it's, I think it's much, much more a mind thing. You know, if you just have the idea of, to actually
just
use the sculpture, and then you'll find a way. Yeah, exactly. So there's lots of ways of doing them. Yeah.
So it depends on how accurate you want your physical visualization to be. And if you want to streamline the production process, you were mentioning data-driven jewelry, for example. And yeah, being able maybe to, as you mentioned, to change every day, we change your jewelry according to, I don't know, your mood, evolution of your mood the last day, or how well you slept, I don't know, your sleep cycles. Then, using digital fabrication automates the process and could make that possible.
The shorter you sleep, the bigger gets your cup. Something I could use.
So how accessible is today this kind of technology? So if I want to buy a printing 3D printing machine, is it something in the order of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands?
It kind of depends. So if you're willing to invest some work and build one yourself, I think they start around maybe 600 euros, something around there. You can get a wrap-wrap. But you have to build it yourself. So you basically go to someone with a wrap-wrap. He prints parts that you need, and you need a few parts more and some motors, and then you can build it yourself. That's quite cheap. Then there are things like MakerBot. There's in New York, there's MakerBot Industries, and they have quite nice small, like, okay, this is not very visible, like small machines that, allow to do 3D printing at home. They've been around for a while now, and they, there's a big community around this by now. And then there's, I recently read about a startup, I think it was from MIT, I'm not sure. They have one of those photo resin things. It's a Kickstarter project. And they will sell it, I think, for $3,000, something like that. And you get a very nice looking machine that's for people who want something nice on their desk. But it's the same thing. You just have a 3D model, you send it, and you can print it.
Okay. But maybe to get started, there's also online services, so you can send stuff to Shapeways or other websites, and then it's really like 50 to 100 euros or so, and you can get a decent piece.
Yes, just the nice thing about Shapeways is that they have all kinds of materials. Mm. So most of these home printers, they all do plastics, and at Shapeways you can even print in metal, and at some point they announce glass. I'm not sure they do that by now. You could have glass objects. You can have them covered with a gold thing, so you can really make a jewelry yourself that looks like it's gold.
Cool.
Yes. And then there are fab labs where you just go. If you live in a big city and there's one, you can just go there and either...
So a fab lab works in a way that they're basically renting the space to you, and then you have to do everything by yourself.
Yeah, there are different concepts. So some require membership, some have open days where you just go there and you bring your material, you can use the machines for free.
Those, it's more like a club, really. Like, you know, there's lots of people hanging around and they help you. And
yeah, it's a bit like a hacker space.
Exactly.
Partially, yeah. There are different concepts. In Amsterdam, for example, they even rent this out to companies and they can book the lab for a day or per hour. And I guess that's how they finance themselves. Okay. But there are also many at universities which are not always, but often open to the public.
Okay. So I guess you guys are planning to do some more research and development in this direction. Is there anything you can tell us about what are your plans for the future?
Well, I'm currently looking into more interactive settings. So what can you do that is kind of more closer to actions, to interactions you can do on a screen infovis application? And well, one example is this, where you can already do sorting and filtering. It's manual, but it's possible. And so there's this whole spectrum between those completely static and added with electronics. And so I'm currently looking into how much do I have to add to get to a certain level of functionality.
I'm seeing little mamushkas for drill down interaction. There's a box and a box and a box.
Excellent idea. Yeah.
Lots of work, though.
A bar chart in a bar chart in a bar chart. nested bar charts. Okay, and are there any classic visualization techniques that you thought about implementing physically other than bar charts? You think there are other techniques that can be easily implemented? It would be nice to see. I don't know. I was thinking about tree maps or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't
so
know.
Tree maps, definitely possible. I was thinking about pie charts. Not very popular necessarily on the screen, but I think they could be very nice as physical objects, even in 3D in stacked versions. And
you could make nice bubble charts with balloons, you know, like actually the whole room, you know, and with like helium balloons with different sizes and different, you know, heights.
A real bubble chart.
A real bubble chart.
A real balloon chart.
Yes, well, that one's actually kind of problematic since I'm trying to have data accurate visualization. So they are, that's why I'm using digital fabrication technology. So they actually accurately represent the data to the accuracy of the machine. And that's quite high for the laser. For the laser, it's about, I don't know, 0.05 millimeters accuracy. So, yeah, that's accurate enough.
By the way, when we worked on the data sculpture for the Emoto project, we also had this idea of testing it with blinds. You know, blind people?
Mm-hmm.
Because they have these highly trained fingers also for, like, you know, feeling heights and so on. Oh yeah, there it is.
Yeah, I was waiting for the moment when we're going to talk about that.
No, we talked about it a few times already. I remembered that we thought it would be really nice to have like a few blind people and talk to them and see how they experience these types of things, how well they can read it, if they would be interested in having something like that and so on. So, I mean, from an accessibility point of view, it's a whole new perspective as well.
Yes, definitely. Although it requires some more, kind of translations, since they are not able to read the labels or the scales which are currently necessary to read this. So even though they would be able to read the data, they wouldn't be able to get to the labels, to the mm-hmm. description, to know what it means.
Yeah, but it's not far away. I mean, you can use Braille writing on the sides, and then you're there.
Yeah.
So another thing I was wondering, did you guys spend any time thinking about what could be the practical applications of physical visualization? So for sure, there is a lot of space for artistic stuff, but is there anything that is more related to functional uses of physical visualization?
I think Moritz mentioned this earlier, that it's very nice to, if you talk about data. So you could imagine this in a showroom of a store to communicate differences between products to customers, or you could imagine in a, I don't know, a business meeting, for example, to print out the sales data from last year to talk about, and I don't know, or as I mentioned before, like the personal data. So those objects are actually quite popular here in the lab, and people, they always ask me if they could have one for their desk as a pretty object. And so I actually could imagine that people would print stuff just to have a nice object.
Yeah. I think there is a connection between physical visualization and ambient visualization. So peripheric objects that you can keep somewhere, and just by the fact that they actually occupy some real space in space, they have a presence, right? And the fact that they have a presence can actually keep, either reminding you some information, or again, as I said, can be some kind of peripheric information you can always refer to. And you know that this object is physically there. So I think this could be a huge advantage.
Yeah, definitely.
You don't have to turn it on.
Yeah, you don't have to turn it on. No, for instance. Yeah, I mean, digital objects are so easy to lose that mm-hmm. that sometimes you have the problem of finding them over and over again, right? But the physical object is something that is there and it has its presence. So I think that's a huge advantage I can see in physical visualization. One thing that I cannot really see how it's going to evolve is how dynamic these interfaces can be. So I think it would be much, much more valuable if we have a physical object that can actually change its shape or color or whatever in time. And it's not clear to me how far we are from having objects like this. Maybe you can briefly comment on this. I think this is what you call active physical visualizations, right?
Yes.
But it's not clear to me how wide is the gap from going from something like the bar chart that you've shown and stuff that can actually, I don't know, be connected to a network and change its shape as the data changes.
Well, there's a trend in HCI to build shape displays or shape-changing displays, which basically are like programmable height surface. So they can usually just change in a 2.5D fashion. So there's, I think I had an example here.
Is there anything you can show on the screen? That would be helpful.
Yes, I have too many windows open here. Yes, there it is. Here. So,
wow.
You see it?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. Okay, this is a shape display built at MIT Media Lab by Daniel Leitinger. It was a demo at the TI conference, I think 4 years ago. And those are controlled by motor faders. So each of these pins can move independently. And they, what does he say there, 120. So those are 120 pins, 120 motor faders. And this is mainly used for this kind of surfaces. So he covered this with, I think it's some kind of latex sheet or something. And so, yes, here you can see this. Yeah, this can be used to for Terran visualizations, so more map-oriented stuff. And then he built another one, which is more a little bit like bar charts, actually. As they... Okay, I'm...
Enrico, will you have copyright problems if we show... a piece of a movie scene from X-Men.
maybe YouTube, you know. Yeah.
Huh? Have it ready. I mean, I don't know.
YouTube has this automatic, you know.
Can I show it even now? Or
yeah. I'm sorry. But I don't find it currently.
Let's try. Let's take this risk.
So this is actually a similar idea. It's a shape changing display, which changes dynamically.
Yeah.
But so a bit like even the thing that Yvonne shown, but a higher resolution. And it's cool to see it in a movie.
Wow. I don't think technically it's that far away. I mean,
no.
There's also, I've recently seen a project using muscle wire, so it's like a wire and you can dynamically change more or less the length. So you can build all kinds of things with that.
And then there is Claytronics, right, Ivan?
Yes, Claytronics, although that's really still far away, I would say, cool. Since it's a project based on nanobots. I had this open too somewhere.
Of course, nanobots. I mean,
it's basically programmable matter. So
smart dust.
Something like that.
Oh. Yeah.
So tiny robots that can be programmed to take any shape, and they have
and wipe out your enemies.
It's on YouTube.
Okay, so it looks like
have
that.
It even if you want.
I have it here, I think. Yes, it's on YouTube, so it should be fine to put it on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Show a YouTube video on
If you put YouTube on YouTube, you can break the internet.
Yes,
I think you should talk.
This is basically the... Claytronics matter, and here it's okay, this... And it supports direct manipulation and it's concept. So
it's not real, right?
Yes, exactly. But this is the future. So at some point, we're probably going to get there and we'll have matter that can just be programmed and...
because the problem with shape displays, the stuff that... we're talking about so far is that you can only do 2D and a half. You cannot show any shape, 3D shape, because you have those spikes and you cannot have stuff which is floating, for example.
Yeah, this is the thing you were mentioning before, right? When you've shown the transparent visualization. Well, but anyway, it looks like the technology is there, so... The gap I was mentioning probably is not too wide. The technology is there, so probably there is a future for active physical visualizations, and this future is not too far away, right? Mm. Well, great. I think it's really interesting what you've shown.
But first, we have to study passive visualizations first, because we still don't know nothing about that. So there is still a lot to study even before those technologies are there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you are planning to study more this kind of static visualizations?
Yeah, for example, something again that we didn't study at all is those physical visualizations that you can rearrange manually. So it's passive, but as Yvonne explained, it's also, in a way, it's active. It's not static. And yeah, sure. There is a huge design space.
Sure. Okay, and there is one last thing that I wanted to ask you. So I guess you keep updating this web page with a long list of physical visualizations. So if any of our listeners wants to suggest additional examples, how can they do it?
We actually asked people explicitly on the website. At the bottom of the website, there are links to our websites with email addresses. And if anybody has a nice addition to this, sure, we're happy to add it. So please send it in.
Okay, great. So you keep updating this webpage, right?
Yes, it's mainly me.
And I will keep adding because I found even the oldest example we have so far is from 35, but I found examples from 1914.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. From the same author, actually, as the book, very interesting book from 39. I think it's Willard Cope Brinton. So we have a few examples from his book. Mm-hmm. It's the book called The Graphic Presentation. And everyone is more or less, lots of people in InfoVis are fascinated by Bertin because, you know, people like discovering, you know, forgotten people who already invented everything, right? And so, yeah, Bertin already had, there is already everything in his book, but Bertin is from, his book is from, I think, 60 or 70s, no? Yes. And Brinton, he wrote a book in 39, and it's really fascinating because you will find in this book lots of things that are quite modern, and even many examples that are mentioned by Tufte are in this book, because Brinton is like Tufte. It's different from Bertin because he's mostly commenting works from others. And you will find lots of similar, like Napoleon's March is there. The train schedule from Marais is there. And he has only 30 citations in Scholar, most of which are not from InfoVis. Bertin has, I checked yesterday, Bertin has 1,700, so it's not that bad. Tufte has 6,400 citations. And he has a previous book, which is from 1914.
Mm-hmm. Wow. 1914. Do you have the book there?
It's actually on archive.org. It's free. It's everyone can access it.
Yeah.
But do you have a physical copy in your hands?
No, unfortunately not. Oh. And the archive book is not, it's kind of low resolution. It hurts your eyes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you should definitely link to it. It's I flipped through it once. I haven't really read it.
It's really cool. Yeah. Yes. You have this, and this one is from 1914. Yes. And many things like time series, so much, much, much older than Bertin. And yet, this is an example of physical visualization from 1913. Cool. So it's the height. So those are actually, strips of wood glued on top of each other. And they show how many passengers take every section of this streetcar.
Nice.
Yes. This is another one with pins, and this one is kind of interesting. Yeah, this one. Have some kind of bar chart on the map, and this is from 1907.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll add more. So newer and older.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, definitely worth checking out both your site as well as the book. I can definitely recommend both. Mm. Yeah.
Cool. I think we have to wrap up. You have to catch your bus.
It's almost you're going to be stuck in the office for the whole night.
Exactly.
Well, make a 10-hour version. Thanks a lot. It's been great to see so many examples to be inspired by the work you guys are doing. I have to say I'm really fascinated by these works, and I'm looking forward to see what happens. I mean, I really don't know. I think the future is totally open, and I want to see what happens now.
Super interesting.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, guys. So we'll add a few links on the blog post of the episode. And again, if you want to suggest anything that can be added to this list, please give a look to the webpage and send an email to them. Okay. Thanks a lot. That's all for today.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us.
Bye-bye.
It was great having you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.